suggested is that I would have a meeting of the researchers and the committee secretaries to see where we can fit in our program. Most probably we will try and do it somewhere next week. I think it's important while we're dealing with the legislation as well that we deal with CIRA's annual report so that we can have an opportunity to discuss in detail those credibility issues that we do have with CIRA and with the Council at this stage. I would also request, Council, you have taken, I hope, note of the issues that we have raised in our deliberations up to now on the serious questions that we have around the authority and the functioning of the Council. That both the Council and CIRA be prepared for the annual report also to discuss those issues in detail. I believe, as members have pointed out, over and above our normal parliamentary responsibilities that's required of us to go through the annual report, we've got an added responsibility, since we are busy with this legislation, to interrogate properly the annual report of CIRA. I would suggest that when we do that, that we would first have a meeting just of the committee and the researchers. The researchers have prepared an analysis of the annual report of CIRA. We will go through the normal process as we do with SAPS, Secretariat, ICD, that we first get briefing from our researchers so that we all have a common understanding of what is contained in the annual report and what the issues are. But I am requesting CIRA and specifically the Council as the oversight body, as part of the oversight bodies on CIRA, to be prepared for a thorough interrogation of the annual report of CIRA and of the issues that were raised during our deliberations on this law. That you go and fetch the copies in the dorms is really
thank you. Could I respond to that? The point that I for the chair's notice. So I think from the council point of view, I just need clarity because your chair mentioned that the committee has that the council and CIRA has no integrity as far as the in the eyes of the committee. Now I need to have clarity on that because if it means that the council members and as a council member I have no integrity, that as a person with integrity, I would consider that it's incumbent on me to resign immediate effect if my integrity is in question, because the Act makes specific reference to council members being fit and proper, understand fit and proper to be a person with integrity. So I just want to clarify what the chair meant, so that I know what we need to report back on and how we need to proceed with that going forward.
We want the council and the authority, when we interrogate the annual report, to address the issues that raise credibility questions in the mind of members. That is what we want the council to do. And we want to ask the council to go to extra lengths to get the answers around those issues that members have raised, but also to be prepared that it will be a thorough interrogation of the report. I think that is this committee's way of working, is that we do what we do thoroughly, that we interrogate annual reports thoroughly. I think we all are in agreement, and it has become clear through this process that there are problems, and we would like to address those problems when we deal with the annual report. If I created the intention that I said integrity, that was definitely not the intention. The intention was to say that there is credibility issues and that we need to address those credibility issues. So I think that is clear from what I'm saying. And that when we deal with the annual report, we want those credibility issues to be addressed. The copies have been made available. Can we continue? We said we were going to start today on page 64. Can I ask if we just get some lights in this committee room, please? Committee section, if you could just arrange that someone switch on some lights in this place. I find it extremely dark. Am I quickly starting on page 64? It's now 66. Okay. 66. Members, can I also indicate to members that we will be finishing today's meeting at 12:15. We will finish today's meeting no later than 12:15. We are scheduled to sit this afternoon with a committee meeting as well. Depending on the progress that we are making, we might take a decision not to continue this afternoon so that we give the technical team enough opportunity to go through the bill, to clean up further, to make the changes that we are asking them to make, and also that we then must properly postpone tomorrow afternoon at 5:00 meeting. I don't see that there's any reason for us to put the committee members under this kind of pressure that we meet at 5:00 tomorrow afternoon if what is happening is not as a result of the committee's own doing, and that we then rather continue next week, Tuesday, as per normal. So we will give what I'm in effect says when we get to the end of this meeting, we will take a decision whether we're meeting this afternoon. If we're not meeting this afternoon, our next meeting will only be next week, Tuesday, as per normal. You can continue. I don't know if it's going to take through page 66.
Chair, thank you very much, and our apology for the lateness of the copies. I'm very sorry that we wasted the time of the committee, but Chair, I propose that we can continue on the new document on page 65. The 66 was the old document, then we can just work from the one document, Chair.
65. Page 65 on the document that was just handed out to members. Can I just get an indication that the researchers also get copies of the new document? Okay, thank you. We can continue.
Thank you, Chair. It is the proposed clause 3A. Any person who fails to comply with the provisions of section 36A 1 or 3 is guilty of an offence and is liable on the first conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years, or to both a fine and such imprisonment, or on a second or subsequent conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 15 years, or to both a fine and such imprisonment. And Chair, section 36A1 was the insertion on the security services outside the Republic as well as 3. Thank you, Chair.
Members, are you happy with that? Are there questions around that one? Honourable George?
The offences we are talking about here, the likely to put an option of a fine. Remember, some of the people we will be dealing with here are, they will have money. They probably would have even made money out of the wrongdoing. Why do you put an option of a fine? I'm not saying it's wrong, but I would like to be educated.
In response to that, Ms. Kulubana?
Yeah, I'm also speaking to that. Am I right that that's actually, we have to do that. We have to leave the discretion to the court. Am I right? I believe that's the case, but I just want to say that you also clarify. Thank you.
General Jacobs, you can respond, please.
Thank you, Chair. Of course, it is an option that's left open. It's a fine or imprisonment, or both. And that's the normal way, and Chair, this relates to the not reporting of the specific action that will take place outside the Republic. So there might be companies involved as well, especially with Section 36A1, where a fine might be a more appropriate sentence.
Is there not normally, can I just ask, is there not normally fines associated with certain, if you say 15 years imprisonment, is there not normally a minimal fine that is suggested as part of that?
Chair, there's a specific law by the Department of Justice which relates to the fines and which are adapted from time to time as the value of money changes. So we never mention the amount of the fine. That's automatically adjusted by the Minister of Justice.
So you're satisfied with that? Okay, then we can continue.
Thank you, dear. I think all that's left is in the schedule, and that was an amendment in the original bill. That's on page 72. The insertion of an new offence in terms of the provision of mercenary activities or regulation of certain activities in country of armed conflict act. You will see it is inserted over and above the regulation of foreign military assistance act. And Chair, the same was done with the Department of Defence with the National Convention on Armed Control Act, where reference is made to both the pieces of legislation dealing with mercenary activities, because the one is not in operation yet. Of course, once the Foreign Military Assistance Act is repealed, automatically it will only be the regulation or the Prohibition of Mercenary Activities Act that will be enforced.
Chairperson, thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. General. I just want to know, how do you put the law that is not in existence at the moment? How do you refer to it, and then how do you say that you put that in the regulation and say that the law, which is not yet promulgated at the moment, how do you do that?
General James.
Chair, it has happened in a number of previous legislation that there was reference to a new act that is not in operation yet, which then create a problem. In terms of the Interpretation Act, if reference is made to a specific act and that act is being replaced by a new act, automatically the reference is to the new act. But in terms of user-friendliness, it's actually better to refer to both, but I think maybe the state law advisors can assist us in this regard as well. But it's just a matter of, you know, if the old act lapses, there's no reference to the new act, and at least you now cover the new act as well. Thank you, Chair.
State law advisors.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with the Union Inspect of the Interpretation Act that it automatically kicks in after the new act comes into operation. But also for clarity purposes, Chairperson, we advise it's best to state the new legislation in the Amendment Act, in the Amendment Bill as proposed. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable McLaughlin.
I'm not arguing, Chairperson, but we are a different committee from this committee that is doing those acts. If that committee decides not to proceed with the act, what will happen? That's my question. If the law itself is not yet promulgated and signed, how then do you take it as an act? Because it's still a bill. It's not an act.
Yeah, I think you must also clarify the fact that it's been through Parliament. It's just waiting for signature and things. But clarify that as well.
Thank you, Chair. The particular legislation, the new legislation, has been passed by Parliament, but it's not enacted as yet. But it's already passed as a law. So, so whenever the, you know, Chairperson, the legislation will only be in, applicable once it becomes enacted into law. But in order to address that, we with the opinion, and it's advised that we rather retain the insertion of the new legislation in order to create certainty. But should the legislation not be enacted, then it won't be referred to. Then the old legislation or the current legislation will still be applicable. That is the situation. There is no lacuna in respect of what legislation is applicable or relevant for the matter. Thank you.
Can I just ask, just courage to say, what is the hold-up, if you do know?
Chair, I'm not 100% sure, but it's the legislation being administered by the Department of Defense. But I think you will recall there was quite political issues, other MCs that were present while the legislation was being enacted. And it might relate to the issue of prohibition, or actually regulation of participation in like Commonwealth countries. I think it might be the same problem that we're sitting here in terms of agreements. In the Commonwealth, there is an agreement that countries of the Commonwealth can, for example, sit in the UK military forces. And I believe at some time, whilst the legislation was under consideration, and I assisted in that committee as well, that there was something like 600 South Africans sitting in the UK government.
It might be that that specific section had been a problem in terms of the putting into operation of the Act. I can't say it authoritatively, but I suspect that might be the problem.
Ms. Are we satisfied with that? Can we just say that what we need as well is that obviously the memorandum accompanying this bill needs to be changed as well. So that will be one of the things that the department, the technical team will have a look at so that we bring it in line. I would like us now to go back because if I understand correctly, we threw a letter or something.
Chair, just on page 73 there was the insertion of any offence in terms of the regulation of intersection of communications and provision of communication-related information act, and also the insertion of any offence in terms of Intelligence Service Act. Thank you, Chair.
Can I just ask you if I understand from media reports that the NTOP will be voting on the Protection of State Information Bill tomorrow? Will you have a look at the possibility whether that act might not also impact here? I'm not saying that it does, but we are saying we want to make sure that we cover everything, that we also have a look on that part of it as well. I don't think it would, but let's just make sure about it. Can we then go back? I would like you to ask...
Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to know, is it standard, and I'm not actually sure that it is, so I'm asking, procedure to have specifically a quite lengthy memorandum on the aims of a bill at the end? I mean, is that the norm? This is now virtually irrelevant, the ones written. I'm just very interested, there were things said in this memorandum that I just don't know where they came from, and we're not actually sure who drafted this bill. So perhaps we could eventually get to the bottom of who put this together and who drafted this memorandum, please.
The fact of the matter is it's standard to have a memorandum in a bill. It also to give those that not interpret the bill and understanding of what thinking behind the bill was, and therefore that's why I'm asking on behalf of the committee that the technical team go and relook the memorandum of the bill and bring it in line. I would like us now to start, Honourable George.
Sir, I don't want to break the debate, but I would advise and appeal that the state advisors and whoever, they must not go and look at that information bill. Whatever at the moment. Because it doesn't matter what happened, Madam Chair, that bill is not going to be in action in South Africa for the next 5 to 10 years. It's going to be challenged, it's going to go to all costs. So, to me, it does not make sense that it is referred to.
That's fine, Mr. George, that's your opinion. I'm still asking them to actually do that because if it seems that it will have an impact, then we will not be fulfilling our duties if we're not having a look at it. If they come back and they tell us no, then so be it. But the fact of the matter is I'm still asking them to do this. Can we now start again, General Jacobs, if we can go back from the definitions. Start at the definitions, please. And I want us also now... And I want members also to check, please, whether members believe that they are not issues that are still outstanding, issues that were raised in the public participation process, issues that we have picked up on that we feel that still needs to be addressed, etc., etc. So if I can ask General Jacobs that you take us through the definitions first, but that we do it slowly. I mean, let's not rush through it. But so we can do a proper analysis of that as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And I believe the reason why the Chair has not asked us to go through the long part is that at the end of the process we will review that as well. Chair, on the definitions, we will start on page 8. The definition of the Levies Act, which is just a technical definition of the Act, abbreviated in terms of better readability of the Act. Shall I continue, Chair? Thanks. Chair, then the definition of locksmith. to delete the word thief. In other words, to delete locksmith means a person who, for the benefit of another person, engages in any activity or business which is related to A, designing and managing master key systems, B, installing, maintaining, repairing and changing the combinations of safes, vaults and safety deposit boxes, C, maintaining key code records, D, cutting keys and duplicating existing keys, or E, opening, closing or engaging of locking mechanisms of any nature by means of a specialized device in any manner. The next definition is also just a technical one, the change the name of the Minister of Safety and Security to Minister Responsible for Police. And then National Treasury means the National Treasury established by Section 5 of the Public Finance Management Act. Chair, shall I continue or do you want to go page by page, Chair?
Can I ask members on page 8 whether there's anything else that you feel from your own notes or from the public participation process that needs to be looked at? Still fine. Page 9?
Page 9, Chair, that's the organ of state means an organ of state as defined in Section 239 of the Constitution, 1996, but does not include the security services referred to in Section 199 of the Constitution.
Is there anything on page 9? Can I just ask a question on page 9? Private investigators is defined here. And Sira must maybe answer this question for us. Are you regulating private investigators at this stage? Sira?
Yes, Madam Chair, we are regulating it.
Can you give us an indication of how many private investigators you've got registered?
I don't have the detail now. I can provide the detail later.
Fine. Can we continue, Pastine?
Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Global.
Sorry, Chair, I'm very interested in that and the question that you asked. What is the answer?
I don't have the number available. Currently, they will provide us with the answer on the number of private investigators.
We need information because it's here in the bill now. We need that information because if the information is not yet completely understandable by the committee, it will injure the bill itself. We need that information. I don't know how we are going to get it, but we need it, please.
Ms. Hotsman, if I can give, no, I don't want you to respond to it. If I can ask that when the CIRA comes before the committee on the annual report, that as part of CIRA's presentation on the annual report, we get a clear picture of what the current situation within the private security industry is. Number of registered companies, number of registered private security, private investigators, number of private security officers registered, active, inactive, that whole, because I think that is some of the things that we are lacking in the annual report in any case. So if I can ask through you, for the council, that we also get that and that form part of the presentation to the committee. Can we continue page 10?
Page 10, Chair, is only the definition of Public Finance Management Act, means the Public Finance Management Act 1999, Act No. 1 of 1999. On page 11, Chair, the definition of security officer means any natural person, A1, who is employed or otherwise engaged by another person, including an organ of state, and who receives or is entitled to receive from such other person any remuneration, reward, fee or benefit for rendering one or more security services, or two, who assists in carrying on or conducting the affairs of another security service provider, and who receives or is entitled to receive from such other security service provider or any other person any remuneration, reward, fee or benefit as regards one or more security service.
Can I ask a question on security officers? Two issues came out during the public hearings. The one was the issue of the car guards and whether this now also means the registration of car guards. That's the one thing. The second thing that came out under the definition of security officers as it is defined now is that it would include people because of the involvement of the state, including an organ of state. whether that means that people that are working for the state will also have to register. That's, I'm just asking as per the submissions that we received. And the third question is, can you explain to us the difference between 2 and B, and why it was necessary? A, 2, and B.
Thank you, Chair. I think regarding the car guards, maybe we can get some guidance from the authority. I'm not sure whether they're actually included, but I think we, if with your indulgence, if we can get some indication from the... I don't think they are registered at present anyway, but maybe what the intention is with this clause, Chair.
I thought, in fact, that the technical committee would have paid attention to this factor because it was raised previously as well. So I'm not going to open the debate now. You've got to come out back to us with clarity on the issue. And if it's worded too widely, then we need to be told so that we can correct it. If it's worded too narrowly, then we also need to be told and motivated why it should be broadened. But can you also just talk on the issue of the organ of state, including an organ of state, that first part who is employed but otherwise engaged by another person, including an organ of state, and then also 2 and B is very similar. What is the difference? Is it not possible to merge them? What was the motivation to have 2 and, you know, still keep B? If you just can comment on that. If you're not sure about it at this stage, indicate, because then it will be one of those things that we come back to the whole definition of security officer.
Chair, on including an organ...
Can I just give Honourable Globo an opportunity?
In your question, Chairperson, it would include C. If you look at that, it would include C too, because it says or C. It would include that one too.
And can I ask, I think for clarity's sake, we must leave security officer at this stage, because it seems like we put in a new definition and there are still an existing definition that is similar to the new definition. So can we just ask the department to come back on, or the technical committee to come back on it? School of Honor?
Sorry to perhaps backtrack a sentence or two. In the responses, I think Sarah put this document together, the responses to the presentations. Sarah said that car guards have always been regulated. I've never seen it. They say that the definition of security services includes car guarding, see Section 1 of the CERA 2001, protecting or safeguarding personal property in any manner. So they say that it includes car guards, but it's almost, to my mind, an uncontrollable sector. I mean, if people choose to pay a car guard £2, they will. If they choose not to, they're not on any obligation, they don't hire them. I don't know, but they seem to claim they are regulated, but I've never seen it.
I would request, Hira, if you claim that, that you then also tell us when you have the annual report how many car guards do you have registered with Hira, and provide us with proof of that. I think the only way that we can deal with this issue is that the technical committee goes back, take in consideration what members have raised around this issue, and come back around the security officer definition that looks also at those issues at B and C that are also almost similar to A1 and 2. Might be that it was intended to be scrapped, or I don't know. But General Jacobs, is it possible for you to respond to the safety issue, or would you prefer to come back on that issue as well?
Dave, I'm sure the intention is that security officers in the service of the state need to fall under the definition, but you will notice that there was an exclusion of security services under the definition of security service provider. So there's definitely a slight difference there. But for other government partners, if there's a security officer in their service, they need to be regulated.
The question I have is that if you don't include that the security company that the state is in business with, surely you start there. They are the ones that should be registered first. So can we ask to bring that whole thing in line? The secretary?
Chair, I think we need to make allowances for two scenarios. The one is where the state contracts out its security of a building. The other is where a state might have in-house people that are doing just security. So I think we need to just make sure we've made allowances for both of those. Just to give you an example, the secretariat buildings are not guarded by the police because of our overnight function. So we have people who are registered with CERA but employed by the civilian secretariat for police. So the employees are they're not another company, they don't belong to another company, who guard our buildings, who perform the guarding duties at the secretariat. So they're in-house to the secretariat, but they're registered with CERA, and that's what I'm talking about.
Can we still ask that you clean up this whole section and if you bring it in line then as well? If there's a requirement that the site must register the individual who's working on the basis directly for the state, then there's the organized state, then there's surely also a requirement that the company that's doing business with state should also be registered. Can we continue, please?
Thank you, Chair. We then go to page 12, paragraph E. In the recognition for security service, the manufacturing, importing, distributing or advertising of monitoring devices contemplated in section 1 of the Regulation of Interception of Communication and Provision of Communication Related Information Act, and which are not listed under section 44 of that act and not affected by the prohibition in section 45 of that act.
Okay, questions on that one? Ms. Kulabana?
Concerns raised about, and I don't know that it hasn't been well dealt with to a certain degree because it's been honed down to interception monitoring device. But a monitoring device, can that not include like a camera outside the door of a house with a screen inside so that you don't let someone in? You know, I fear, just the word monitoring is a bit broad and you may find manufacturers of a little screen and a camera suddenly have to jump through all the hoops. I don't think that's what's intended. I may be wrong, but that's what it actually says here. So monitoring devices are a problem because it's too vague. Monitoring of what? I mean, if you've got someone, or a beam across the garden, is monitoring whether someone is walking through the garden. Is that now also included? I see this definition is very broad and could put a huge burden on companies who do plain manufacture very ordinary equipment. Please just give us a clue what you're meaning.
Honourable and Global.
Chairperson, let me come to the understanding of this paragraph. If you read this paragraph, colleague, it says monitoring, then jump to the regulation, leave all the other good devices contemplated in section 1, leave that, and just come to the regulation of the bill, of the Act itself, Act number 70 of 2002, which is already been promulgated. That's where the link is. As far as the explanation is concerned, as far as their explanation is concerned, the people who are presenting this thing, they said that if those mechanisms or those devices, the small devices, as long as they are within the law of interception and so on, therefore, under this regulation, they are capable to be overseen by this regulation. That is why they put this regulation within. That is why I say If you read Ms. Barnett, the monitoring and then jump to regulation of the act, then you will be able to tie it down to see exactly which focus focusing this paragraph. But I'm not responding on their behalf. That's my understanding on it.
And I just ask that you, monitoring devices are regulated in any case through this act that we're speaking about, so the omnibus law is quite correct. It is regulated. But what worries me about that section is, and maybe we just need an explanation. This specific act that refers to interception device means any electronic, mechanical, or other instrument device, equipment or apparatus which is used or can be used whether by itself or in combination with any other instrument, device, equipment or apparatus to intercept any communication that does not include, and then it is decoupled. Now it says monitoring device means any electronic, mechanical or other instrument or device, equipment or apparatus which is used or can be used whether by itself or in combination with any other instrument, device, equipment or apparatus to listen to or to report any communication. Monitoring device is about communication, not referring to then listed equipment under 44, the one that you refer to in this. The minister must, by noting the Gazette, this is not the Minister of Police, declare any electronic, electromagnetic, acoustic, mechanical, or other instrument, device, or equipment, the design of which renders it primarily useful for purpose of interception of communications. That's what it's about. Under conditions and circumstances specified in the notice to be listed equipment. So if I understand correctly, and I'm trying to understand, are we covering the monitoring and the interception device through this? And secondly, if I understand it correctly, CEDAW will then regulate the manufacturers, distributors and advertisers of those that have been gazetted by the minister. Not the Minister of Police, the Minister, I presume it's communications or whoever else, Justice, by the Minister of Justice. Can you just give clarity on that issue?
Chair, yes, I have a copy of the notice of the Minister of Justice available, which we will make available to the members. If I can just mention, for example, the first item on the list listed by the Minister of Justice is any instrument, device or equipment which is capable of being used to access, record, monitor or retrieve communications from a computer without the permission of the author of the communication. And then the Minister says what is prohibited: to manufacture, assemble, possess, sell, purchase or advertise any of these instruments. Chair, what I want to say is that these devices are specifically mentioned here, and also which of them may not be sold, manufactured, advertised, etc. In other words, what we try to achieve here, and it is as a result of the fact that the Interception and Monitoring Act that has been repealed didn't have this regulation of monitoring equipment in it. So previously, a shop could do business in any of these items, import, export, whatever. So the items that are listed by the minister specifically in the notice may not be manufactured, sold, advertised, etc. So in other words, if you have a normal camera, and I think, Chair, you did allude to that, you can also do surveillance with a video camera. You can record it. But it's where such equipment has specifically been adapted to do it surreptitiously without the permission. And when it comes to the monitoring of computers, specific, if I can say, type of spyware which is involved. But it's not a very long list. It's four items that's listed, as well as in the actions that are prohibited in terms of the notice.
General Jacobs, I'm confused because those are prohibited. So what are we trying to regulate here? They're not supposed to be manufactured, they're not supposed to be advertised, they're not supposed to be distributed through another act. So why is it that we are trying to regulate here?
say exactly what we're saying here. Items which are not listed or prohibited in terms of the Monitoring Act.
To see why.
Yeah, I think that it would be important for us to come back to you with the list of the devices, because the emphasis is on interception of communication and not normal monitoring processes. So I think what we would need to provide to this committee is a list of exactly what those non-prohibited devices that are interception of communication, as opposed to a camera which I agree to put in my house that's not intercepting anybody else because it's with my approval. I think what we need to do for the committee is to come back to you with a list of examples of those sorts of devices in terms of the Act and the schedules and the what has been declared, so that we could fully understand this issue better.
So, because before I come to you, is part of the problem not the use of the word monitoring? Should it be interception? But look at it. I'm not saying you must change it now. Please look at it. Look at the consequences and come back to us on that issue. Ms. Kulabana?
Yeah, I'm imagining, and I haven't read it, that in the Interception and Monitoring Prohibition Act, it's detailed, etc. Is it necessary for us to repeat what's in another act? I'm not sure if even we need to refer, because usually we don't double dip when it comes to if the law already exists, we don't have to reinvent it. But I agree absolutely. I think it's the use of the word monitoring. Although it is used in that. Regulation of Interception... Oh, no, it's not. The Interception and Monitoring Prohibition Act. But I think in using monitoring, that's what's causing a lot of the difficulty.
General Judge, you wanted to react?
Okay, thank you. I think we share sentiment about this. Because my concern when I read the provision that was here was just changing the name from the previous Act to the new Act and didn't take into account that there are certain items which are prohibited. If we can come back and say maybe whether we leave it out in terms of it's being regulated in terms of the Interception Act, I think what we welcome from the Department is that, you know, that we have spotted that you can't regulate something that's prohibited. And I think that is the main gist of this issue, and we will definitely come back and say we need to further refer to it in the Act, or we can actually delete it from that.
It will be one of the things that we would expect you to come back to us on Tuesday then, is the Section E members, so that we can get clarity on it. Continue, please, page 13.
Thank you, Chair. 13 was then the insertion of paragraph LA, protecting or safeguarding of cash or goods with a high value, including precious metals or jewellery when transported on a public road, except when transported by a person at his or her own account or by the South African National Defence Force when the case of transport by escort officers.
Ms. Hobby, I'll be with page 30. Is there anything else under page 13?
Thank you, Chair. On page 14, Chair, you will see that that subparagraph 2 has been deleted.
Sorry, can I interrupt here just before we continue? I'm just reading from the notes as well. The whole issue about the locksmith and it being a trade, have that been addressed?
Chair, we did have a discussion about the locksmith and the trade issue, and we felt that the definition couldn't distinguish between the two. That was the role of the association to distinguish. But I think the issue that we maybe have missed out on was the issue of, and if I remember correctly, was the issue of internships, where a locksmith conducts an internship or an apprenticeship at a locksmith. And I think that's something that we need to come back to committee to address.
Lucy, if I can just remind you, the locksmiths raised the issue about the fact that they are required to register people that are starting training as locksmiths for CIRA, which they don't have a problem with. But then CIRA prohibits those people until they are fully qualified to do the job of a locksmith. Now, because it's a trade, that person must do key cutting while he's busy training. It's like a mechanic. You work on a car in order to become a qualified mechanic. So they were asking us that we just bring that in line with the SACWA requirements around it. So I'm just asking this technical committee look at that again, because it raises a problem. Because now Mr. Ndlovu is a qualified locksmith. He's got three people that are apprentices with him. He's trained them at his cost. But he can't use them he can't basically teach them because they're not allowed to be doing locksmith work. But they are required to do locksmith work in order to qualify. And I think we just need to bring the software issue in here. Maybe it's a two-way registration. Once when you start off and once when you're fully qualified or whatever the case may be. And maybe, General Jacobs, if we can ask you, the statewide advisors do have the telephone numbers and the contact detail of the locksmiths if you want to get in contact with them again around this issue. Sorry, I'm sorry to take it back.
Thank you, Chair. Then on page 14, Chair, just a reference there, we have deleted paragraph 2 on the top of the page because we've been asked to shift that to further in the book. So you will find similar provision that we've inserted later on. Chair, then we go to page 16. It was the insertion of paragraph R.
Before we go to page 16, I just want to ask you, Ms., whether there are anything else on 14 that you still want to have a look at. Can we ask you, General Jacobs, do you not mind, if you do not mind, just take us through the objects of authority quickly. I think it's important that we just re-familiarize ourselves about it as well.
Okay, then on page 14, the primary objects of the authority are to regulate the private security industry and to exercise effective control over the practice of the occupation of security service provider in the public and national interest and the interest of the private security industry itself, and for that purpose, subject to this Act, to promote a legitimate private security industry which acts in terms of the principles contained in the Constitution and other applicable law. B, to ensure that all security service providers act in the public and national interest in the rendering of security services. C, promote a private security industry which is categorized by professionalism, transparency, accountability, equity, and accessibility. D, promote stability of the private security industry. E, promote and encourage trustworthiness of security service providers. F, determine and enforce minimum standards of occupational conduct in respect of security service providers. G, encourage and promote efficiency in and responsibility with regard to the rendering of security services. H, promote, maintain and protect the status and interest of the occupational security service provider. I, ensure that the process of registration of security service providers is transparent, fair, objective and concluded timely.
Sorry, Chairperson. What does I must be mean?
Sorry?
I must be. What does it mean?
Timely. I understand why the Honourable Member is asking that question. Because what is timely for one is not timely for the other. Can we look at that as well, please? I mean, I see the state law advisor smiling, but I'm just looking at thinking about the administrative justice principle again. You are dealing with people's livelihood. If a security officer is waiting half a year before he gets registered, it is an issue. So can we...
just on this particular issue, Section 3 of the Principal Act relates to the objects. It's only the ideals of the authority, so it's not really substantive provisions dealing with time frames. It's basically the idea of having things on time, basically. So it's ideals set out in the object rules, the broader principles that have to be given effect to by the authority. But we can look at the comment.
Honourable Ngobo, can I ask that you make a note yourself about it as well, because when we come to the section that deals with registration, I think that is where we need to look at it again to see whether the word is used there again or whether we are specific in terms of the time frames as well. Continue, please.
Thanks, Chair. The paragraph J, promote a standard in the training of security service providers and prospective security service providers. K, to encourage ownership and control of security business by persons historically disadvantaged through unfair discrimination. L, encourage equal opportunity employment practices in the private security industry. M, promote the protection and enforcement of the rights of security officers and other employees in the private security industry. N, ensure that compliance with existing legislation by security service providers is being promoted and controlled through a process of active monitoring and investigation of the affairs of security service providers. O, protect the interests of the users of security services. P, promote the development of security services which are responsive to the needs of users of such services and of the community. Q, promote the empowerment and advancement of persons who were historically disadvantaged through unfair discrimination in the private security industry. And a new insertion, R, develop and implement a plan to promote awareness among the public and private security industry on the functions and role of the authority and the industry. And Chair, I must say this was this is a recommendation. It was not agreed to by the committee, but we feel in terms of the present situation, it will be a very positive issue if there's a better understanding for both the role of the authority and the industry, with public as well as industry.
What will the financial implications of that be?
Chair, I think just to maybe, because I was one of the people that motivated for being put in, is that many of us, the portfolio committee, people who work in the department, people who've worked on issues around the industry are aware that if you register a private security guard, they need to be registered if you're a private security guard. But if I ask my next door neighbours, have you checked to see if your private security guard is registered with CERA? I'm sure they wouldn't even know what CERA is. Now, for us, the cost implications should not be a factor in this, because there are ways of dealing with communication which do not necessarily require the use of community radio stations where you actually talk about the issue. There's a huge amount of issues that government deal with where they don't necessarily have to go out and put out paper adverts and paper things, where you make use of media platforms that already exist, interviews on different language stations, etc. But there are ways of communicating with public. There are also government platforms that you can use to communicate with the public without necessarily now having to come up with like an 80 million rand communication strategy. But so for us, the principle of putting this in is to make sure that everybody knows that there is this authority. If you have a guard at your house, they should be registered or armed, but that you actually make use of existing platforms, that you don't now go and spend a huge amount of money on billboards and adverts in newspapers, that you can actually use platforms that exist, writing articles in newspapers which you don't have to pay for to do that.
Yeah, just never say, for us it's not a financial cost, because I mean for us it is. Is Kulabana on the global?
I doubt, I'm just checking because I don't think, I'm second guessing myself. I don't think it should be listed here, or maybe it should be the experts. Some sort of mechanism or area, if people have a problem with, let's say they see one, they believe it's giving them a problem, the guards are hassling them. Can they actually go to CERA? Is that their role as a complaint mechanism, or should there be a civilian oversight body that they can go to complain about private security? I don't know if this is the appropriate place or not, but I haven't seen it elsewhere.
Honourable Ndlovu.
Jefferson, what is the difference between K and Q? What is the material difference between K and Q?
Another place where it is as well. There's three references. Can I must explain that. But can I say, I think this is extremely wide. And it's very unfocused. And can we ask that the technical committee also look at this and try and focus these issues? What is it that ultimately CERA should be doing? Should register, should regulate, etc. But I'm going to give you opportunity to respond to Honourable Ndlovu's question. Honourable Molebatsi.
My question is also on the difference between K and Q.
Maybe that is not what you are saying. Maybe that doesn't take care of what we are asking with the Honourable Parts. If they look at the combining, because it's too long, that is why I'm asking the differences. the material differences between those two lines. But if they take what they are saying, maybe it will be better if they look at it in a summary way.
I really think we need to look at this, because I really think it is, you know, it's actually giving, expecting of Sira things that it will never be able to do, not because of Sira, but because of the reality of the situation. And we need to be more specific in what it is. Just a technical issue as well, before you answer the Ms. Kulaban's question, is after Q, after industry, shouldn't there be an and if you're going to the next one? Just a technical thing. You can respond to the question.
Chair, first I can just say this wording we've used comes from the DPCI legislation, the role of the Secretariat in respect to the judges, the complaint judge. We have used that wording, but I appreciate what the committee has said in terms of review of that. In respect of oversight body, I think CIRA itself, to a large extent, should be the body where complaints regarding the industry should go, because they have the oversight body of the council, and there's also a degree of oversight by the minister. And of course you have all these other oversight bodies, but I think primarily CIRA should be the body that if you have complaints about the industry that you should go to, whether it's about registration, whether it's about service delivery, and all those issues. Chair, thanks.
Chair, I mean, I think the intention is always that CIRA is able to receive complaints. They wouldn't necessarily handle them in the sense of investigate that particular complaint, but that complaint could spark an inspection on that particular company, etc. So I think what we need to come back to the portfolio committee is to say what are the mechanisms that exist and are they effective, and do we need to strengthen them in terms of this bill. But I think the chairperson's point about looking at the objectives in a totality and coming back with more refined objectives, because some of the objectives here also verge on whether you are a regulatory body or whether you're an association that's promoting an industry. I think that's another issue we need to look at in those objectives.
Another thing that is bothering me as well, because promote comes out quite often in these objectives. Now, if you are supposed to be a regulating body, it becomes contradictory, so maybe we can just look at some of those issues. Anything else on page 60, members? We ask that the same be done around the functions of authority. Because I think if we want to bring if we want to bring the objects of authority, if we are going to look at that, we need to look consequentially at the functions of the authority as well. Because it's under the functions of the authority, conduct an ongoing study and investigation of the rendering of security services and practices of service providers in order to identify shortcomings in this Act. It's never happened. This committee is doing it after 10 years. Today. So, you know, I really think we need to have a look at these two, because it's extremely long. It's like a wish list. You know, provide information to the users, prospective users or representatives of users of security services regarding compliance of security service providers with the provisions of this Act, which means I should be able, and that was the idea originally, Honourable George will remember it, that if I want to employ a security officer, I would have asked that security officer for his CIRA card. I should have been able to put the number of that CIRA registration in my computer, and it should have been checked whether this person is actually registered with CIRA. So I really think we need to be realistic about what it is here and maybe just have a relook at all of this. I mean, it's four pages. So are we in agreement with that, members, that they also have to look at that? Okay. Then can we bring governance of authority? General Jacob, GG, organ of state, you've used the small S previously, so we can just look at that as well.
Okay, I will just go through the governance of the authority, section 5, the present section 5. Authority is governed and controlled by the council, contemplated in section 6 in accordance with this Act. The authority acts through the council And all acts of the council are regarded as acts of the authority. The authority must be impartial in the performance of its functions and must ensure that in the taking of decisions or other steps, it complies with all legal requirements for just administrative action. The authority must otherwise perform its functions in terms of this Act and the Levies Act and in accordance with such guidelines and policy directions as may be issued by the Minister from time to time. And Chair, maybe we can just add to the Public Finance Management Act.
Anything here? You wanted to comment?
Yeah, Chair, something which wasn't raised by the committee, but we would like to look at is and look at the wording thereof is clause 2 of this section. The authority acts through the council and all acts of the council are regarded as acts of authority. While we need to retain that the council, that an aspect of that the council has oversight and must approve certain things, we also want to, we need to draw a distinction between the authority and the council as the oversight body. So we just want to look at the wording of that and come back to you with a rephrased wording on that.
Just explain to us 5, governance of authority 5.
Mr. Chair, guideline or policy direction issued by the Minister in terms of this section may be amended, withdrawn, or substituted by the Minister by notice in the Gazette. Chair, it's a very wide provision actually, which can sort of nullify previous policies, etc. I don't know whether it was done in respect of the oversight role of the Minister. But I think it can, it's extremely wide provision.
Can we ask that you also look at that? I think it refers to 4, that it speaks to 4. But just have a look at that, so we can tighten that as well, please. 6, there was an issue raised by the Honourable George yesterday that I think we as a committee now need to discuss as well. And that is the issue that the Honourable George raised about what type of council do we want. And there he wasn't talking only about, he said, don't only look at negatives, he said look at the positives as well. I suppose you're going to respond to that now. Okay. Let's give you an opportunity and then we'll open to the members.
Yes, sir. I think there was very little said about the qualifications. And once again, we've looked at the DPCR legislation and what's required in terms of the head of the DPCR. And we thought many of those issues are applicable. This proposed clause 6A should, of course, be underlined because it's the insertion. And it reads that a member of the council for the authority must be a fit and proper person with due regard to his or her experience, conscientiousness, and integrity to be entrusted with the responsibilities of the office concerned. Chair, although it's not very elaborative, but if you look at the contents of this, the experience which must be relevant, conscientiousness, and then of course I think the committee referred a number of times yesterday to the integrity issue linked with the vetting must be done. Thank you, Chair.
That is as it was put by the technical committee after the issue was raised by Mr. George. If we look at 6 as well, should we not be looking at specific qualifications? And with that, I'm not saying degrees or anything like that, understanding correctly. But shouldn't we say, we say here, this is how the council must look at chairperson, and vice chairperson, and 3 additional councillors. Should we not look at the possibility of saying of which one must have a financial background, one must have, because it's their oversight. It's about governance, it's about finances, it's about management. Or shouldn't we be more specific about, do we want a legal person here? Do we want somebody that can look at the finances of CIRA, a financial expert, somebody that understands government, that understands the security industry, that understands security, not the security industry, security. I don't know. I'm putting it on the table for members to look at. I'm trying to address also, I think 6A addresses to some extent the Honourable George's issue, but I think there still remains issues open. And maybe a council must also comment on their experience in terms of that. What would you think you would require there to be more effective as such? Ms. Kobana?
It was referred to a moment ago about the vetting. I'm not sure who actually does the vetting. Where is there reference to that? You referred to it a moment ago about the vetting of these people. And it just seems to me that the members of this council, I'm watching in many of the other portfolio committees, and they have a body, the committee actually interviews all the candidates and puts forward a panel to the minister for approval. I'm wondering why we're leaving this to the minister and the cabinet. Why are we not doing the job as so many other committees do? They do all the interviews themselves. Just a thought.
Honourable Mullins.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. On your last comment, I thought maybe it would be advisable to take it as to the council, using their experience, maybe if they can just give us the background, maybe we'll be able to do things properly as members of the committee.
Enforcement?
Thanks, Chair. I think if the committee would benefit from my very brief experience in the council, without sounding flippant, I think it would be important that there is some guideline, I think, attached to this provision so that it is understood the basis on which members are appointed to the council. I'm saying that also as council members, I think it's important for individuals sitting on the council that the position is reviewed as one that carries responsibility but also carries respect. So that there wouldn't be comments that people have been appointed because it's a pretty face or picture on a photograph or an issue like that, but that it would be members who have been appointed for specific contributions and value to add. I think there would be a level of subjectivity, but I think it's useful if it is a guideline to cover the areas that require the sort of competency a council needs to act its responsibility or to carry out its responsibility. I think the example that one looks at sort of some entities across the board, the general issue or difficulties council members have would be one around governance. And if I'm giving advice, I would say let us look at the council members who are competent in the field of governance. I think areas like financial management, legal services or experience, etc., obviously is of great value, but I think we might also be too restrictive if we specify it in those specific terms, but I think there needs to be some guideline attached to it. I don't know if it's in the appropriate provision. I think the clause that stands is an important one, but perhaps we need to refer to guidelines to be developed and agreed upon at some point, and how that exists, I think would be extremely valuable to council members who don't have to be in the forum where they have to defend their position of integrity. I think in respect to the member at Ola Barnett's question about the committee interviewing people, quite frankly, if I knew what it takes and is expected to be on council of a body of this nature, I doubt whether I would have done it. If only for the love of my country, I would. But if people are not being paid, are not being remunerated, and you're doing that to be subjected to interviews, etc., if it's an appointment post, I don't know whether you actually would be able to fill that position when we have vacancies. We're already struggling with that. I do think there is probably a review of what we mean by it, but I'm not quite sure that that actually answers that question. But guidelines that need to be developed in terms of competence required would be of assistance and value to council. Thanks.
Members, I'm actually just thinking that after C, 6C, that we put a sentence of which at least one must be a legal person and one must be a finance person, something like that. That's basically what I'm saying. So that we have people that can look at the oversight. So with 0.5, I think also members would be got to differentiate that this is a part-time council. The councils that are interviewed are full-time councils, most of them. And also the committees interview make a shortlist and the president still appoints. But I would suggest here that we really look at the possibility of adding, and we've had it in some other legislation as well, where we put in what is the issues that is for us, and I think here now we've heard the council, now it's the committee that must apply its mind. What is for us the issues that must be addressed? Finances is obviously an issue. So maybe finance, legal issues I think would always be of an assistance, and then a governance those three. Honourable Mother Batsi.
And what about the security background?
Honourable George.
Madam Chair, I must be honest, I will not hide your face, but I'm very uncomfortable with all the qualifications you're putting to the council. I think to me, if we say fit and proper person, people of integrity, and probably if we say one person's legal background, well, I'm worried about making this council, you see, even the issue of interviews, I don't believe that you need such a grilling of interview when you appoint a council, because those people are part-time, that's number one. Even in terms of, I'm not sure some of them will agree, assuming you take a retired person who is living his life, he's running his business, but he's prepared to serve in the council. But integrity of all the things. Now you say he must be better. Do you think he's going to agree? Might not agree. Or it might not, he might not want, but why should he be better? Because the basis of employing the person first is that this is a person of integrity, a person who has got an impeccable reputation which is tarnished. So I'm saying, Madam Chair, we can add. And it's a legal, but I'm not sure you want to put lots of qualifications, and especially in the fact that this is a part-time thing, these people are doing it. But as I'm saying, if the majority of the committee feels that these people must have all these qualifications, I think this qualifies to me, consciousness, integrity, people with responsibility. Well, you don't just jump on that. It's based on the information which you had about that person.
Sometimes the Honourable George amazes me. He's arguing against himself now because it was him that raised the issue yesterday. I think there is value in it for this committee to also give the minister guidance in terms of what it is that we are looking for in a council. We, even if you look at the... I'm trying to think about some of the legislation that we've passed. We've done it in the past, where you say, of which at least one person should be a legal person and one person should be a finance person. I can't see that this council can do proper oversight over the authority if they do not have somebody who understands government finances, the PFMA, etc., and who can look at the statements of CIRA in an objective and an informed manner. So I would strongly motivate, obviously I will be led by the committee, but I would strongly motivate that we do look at certain types of people that we want. Not the integrity issue, I think we all are in agreement with, that paragraph. We're looking at the paragraph above it, point six. That's the paragraph that we are looking at. Honourable Nombo, Honourable Lobo, and Honourable Klebanat.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. If I might suggest that, as we are saying, that the Honourable George is saying, let us not be charged, let us not insist on qualifications, but I would suggest that at least on the level of the chairperson at least must have one of the two kind of qualifications in terms of the legal background or in terms of governance, so that he will be able to guide the council itself, you know, at that level, at least. Thank you.
Chairperson, I don't want to be specific to the position. I'm talking about the council as a whole, because I'm talking about five people here. We need those three things, governance, law, and finance, because they are dealing with finance, they are dealing with governance, because they are looking at the bills and so on and so forth, and they are looking at the law, because they are consumed at the end of the day, as an entity. Those are the three things that should have to be there. But I'm not looking at any position. That is why I'm putting that three things, because I don't want to allocate it to deputy or whatever. But in the council, it's up to them how they get their sense.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you that we must ensure that the people on the council have the oversight qualifications or the qualifications to do adequate oversight. I think that has probably been why we've had difficulties with this body before, because the oversight was not sufficiently stringent or perhaps didn't have the expertise to do the job adequately. So I think absolutely we need to sit in. And I totally agree with the legal, and I think, I wasn't sure how to put it. I said managerial, you said another way. I think yours was probably better. But those three qualifications, I think, are crucial. And it doesn't matter who has them, as long as they bring that expertise. And I'm not talking about having been graduated 6 months ago. I'm talking about people with 5 years experience in each of those, or you know, a term that would ensure they have the gravitas to bring value to the council.
I think we've got general agreement on this issue. Can we ask the drafting team to go and look at the wording of something under six? I'm not opening the debate again.
Yeah, that was something we haven't raised that we just dealt with before, but I just want to draw the attention to the issues raised in respect to the part-time council. We're looking at the competencies and look at what is required. But I do find, just my own experience, that it is restrictive having 5 members, and whether we should look at that given the array of requirements and responsibilities of council, whether we shouldn't maybe give consideration to back two more, just to get a balance and have the availability of council to function effectively and not be timed by the restriction of that number. I'm just putting that up if it is something the committee wish to consider.
We actually did discuss this issue. We did discuss this issue and we decided that the 5 is sufficient, and also that it's now, if I'm wrong, but I believe we did discuss this issue. Honourable Lombo,
I remember well, we did touch on the matter yesterday to say 5 people are enough for the council, because we said we don't want to open it to a large group of people, but we had an agreement yesterday that 5 was okay.
I understand where the deputy chairperson comes from, because we started debating the matter when she was not present. It was General Drama who was present when we started debating the issue, but we finalized it yesterday when we said 5 is fine.
Can I ask members what we should consider as well is maybe looking at the secretariat for the council. That will have financial implications, but I mean, that is surely something that one can look at the secretariat for the council, where one can then also address the issues of special skills that is needed. And we're not talking about a huge body. It can never be bigger than the council, but it can be expert advisors for the council. It can be people that are financially qualified or whatever the case may be, and they can actually play some sort of role. George and then...
Probably when this thing is brought back, I'll discuss it. Because if you are now going to extend over section, what is this authority going to do? Because I put this authority for the responsibility to work for the council and do all the work. Now we're going to have a secretary for the council. What are they going to do?
Mr. George, we will discuss that issue, but I think it's quite clear that the authority is an oversight body. They cannot depend on the persons that they are supposed to be overseeing to provide them. As much as we have the same challenge, we're an oversight body, that's why we strengthen our research unit. We say we don't only want information that comes from the department, we want our own independent information as well. So there is an argument for that. Ms. Kulabana?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was referring to earlier, where, you see, we sit for the situation where civilians, they can't go to CIRA with complaints about people. They don't know where to go, and if there was a body such as yours, but in a small form, then and it was put out there, this is the body, if you have a problem, that's where you go. I think that would deal with the entire issue, because there is nowhere to go. I mean, if people are uncomfortable, if they believe that a certain security group are actually not registered or have a problem, it's not a sex matter, who do they go to? It's a complaint. We need a complaint division, but a civilian complaints division. I think that would answer that exactly.
I think mainly we must be careful. We must differentiate between the complaints, because that's CIRA's responsibility. CIRA must deal with that. That's why they're regulating authority. But what we are, I think what members are in agreement with is that the council, especially when we say it's now a part-time councillor, including the chairperson, is that the council should depend on a secretariat. And that we look at how we can word something around that. It doesn't have to be big, but a secretary that can do work for it. Mr. Ndlovu, and then I want the Secretary of Police to respond.
Chairperson, I will go along with that idea because of two things. You see, if the people are part-time, they are not there every now and then, 24 hours, 7 days a week. And secondly, if the chairperson is somewhere else and the deputy chairperson is somewhere else, there is a lot of job to phone these people to coordinate a meeting, whatever. There should be somebody who will be in the office to make sure that the coordination is done properly and keeps the records and so on and so forth. It mustn't be the authority, because the authority itself will be questioned by the council, because they may say, we don't need a May, I'm just using an example, we don't need a May meeting, we will have it in July, only to find that in July the council is all, the authority is dissolved. That's the thing I'm supporting the secretariat about. Because the secretariat, we are talking about two people, can't be two, three people, who will be just a person who is sitting on a desk to coordinate the work of the council together with the authority.
If you wanted to respond, and then
I wanted to say that I think it's an important concept to have that, and the issue is going to be in defining what the role is. The role is not to do the work of the authority, but to make sure that the council has all the information and the right information and is replacing the right information in that council's files. Because it's an oversight structure, if you rely on the authority, certain information may never make it onto the agenda. So I think the issue is that the principle is an important one that we as doctors need to look at, but we need to define that secretary to make sure that it's not performing the role of function, it's actually servicing the council and not the authority.
We are now asking the technical team to go and have a look at that. It's, as much as it's important that they don't do the role and function of CIRA, they must also not exercise the role and function of the council. They must just be preparing for the council, gather information, etc., etc. Okay. Members, can we break for ET is ready?
Don't say, Madam Chair, because I don't believe this matter is finished. When they talk about these services which people are talking about, they must tell us what is going to be functions. Because you're talking about a body that is...
Ms. Butch, that's just what we said. They must not only look at the body, they must also come back with us in terms of the functions of it. Members, it's 5 to 11. Can we be back at 10 past 11, please? He is ready. Can Can we start this? You can continue.
Thank you, Chair. On page 22, clause 8, or section 8, 1, a council is subject to the section.
Just before you do, on 22 under 7, I think if not a fit and proper person to hold office as a councillor must now be removed from there because we're talking about fit and proper in the new 6A. If you can just pick up on that one as well, please. Sorry for the interruption. You can continue.
Thank you, Chair. A councillor is subject to this section, appointed for a period not exceeding 3 years on such terms and conditions as the minister may determine in a letter of appointment, provided that all members of council serve on a part-time basis.
Continue.
Sorry, Chairperson. On 7, 7E, did we agree for the clearance? What did you say about that?
Members, currently it is in the Act.
Why am I I'm not jumping on your Chairperson? You recall that in some of the inputs by other people on the public participation, public inputs, they talk about the clearance and so on and so forth. But I saw it here and then I marked it because I wanted to know how is the feeling of the committee and the law, state law of us about it. 7E.
I think, Honourable Law, if I could remember correctly, the clearance issue during the public participation process was more related to the criminal record centre check of security officers, that clearance, and not to the clearance, not to the vetting of the council members. This is council members. They haven't taken it out. It stays as is. Honourable Lover, I can't hear you.
Chairperson, qualification now. Appointment of a council. Or has no job.
Okay, you can continue. We're now looking at a councillor subject to the second appointed for a period not exceeding 3 years on such terms and conditions as the minister may determine in a letter of appointment provided that all members of the council sit on a part-time basis. That's the suggestion that came from this committee. Honourable George?
Madam Chair, I was looking at the time this checking also with the deputy chairperson. Looks like this council met 4 times or probably maximum 6 times. Now, I'm asking, is 3 years, because it's with the problems which we've seen in many years, I'm not talking about the present, but even in the past.
Sorry, Mr. Chuck, I don't want to suppress your comment, but it's still coming. It's under Section 12. We're still coming to that section, that deals with meetings, the council.
No, I was talking in the 3 years.
Oh, the 3 years. Okay.
The 3 years, I was wondering whether it's not advisable to take it to 5 years, give them, you see, sometimes people come to the council and then, before they know what's happening, of course, I know they are eligible for re-election, but I was just wondering whether 5 years is not a reasonable time, which normally most bodies, they give somebody 5 years to do a job.
Can I hear you on the issue of the 3 years or 5 years? Are there any strong feelings again or for Mr. Malombo, Honourable Malombo?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I would like to agree with Honourable George, because within the period of 3 years,
person hasn't find him or hasn't some kind of ground to understand the dynamics of a situation that he or she has or supposed to have in. So I would suggest that we give them at least 5 years. Because just to fair multiple, they are part-time for that matter. So 5 years, I think it will be sufficient.
Thank you. Ms. Kulavana?
You know, these members are unpaid.
Sorry, I think we must just correct that thing as well. Is that it's only those that are otherwise employed by government that don't get voted.
Indeed. All right, let's start that again. Those who, so in other words, if they are already government employees, yes, they have a say, but it is still another area of responsibility that they're taking on. And I don't know, because I've not spoken to any of them, and I don't know that we should, that a five-year period may not feel too onerous. I mean, it's a massive commitment to set aside that sort of time. Certainly, you know, other members, we may find there are no members on it who work for government departments in future. It's not compulsory that they must be. But it does seem that they've been pulled out and said, do your duty here, but for 5 years is a very long time to do that. So I can't speak for the people who've sat on there, but I don't know that we shouldn't be consulting with them, saying, well, is 5 years too long? How is it felt? Because it's a huge commitment to undertake.
I think before I give the Honourable Ndlovu Sisulu, can I just get a clarity? They're not getting paid, but do you get allowances for attending meetings? Oh, nothing. Okay, so there's nothing there. Okay, Honourable Mlover, you had your hand up on the five-year issue?
Yes, Chairperson, because I was thinking the same way as Mdule. It seems as if we're thinking the same way. Same way as Mdule and Lambo. You know, Chairperson, because we are talking about 4 meetings within a year, something like that, not more than that. And maybe we can talk about the claims or whatever at the end, but let's talk about this year, the timing at the moment. I think 5 years will be fine to them, because they will know exactly of what to do. And any member of the council has a right to resign or whatever, or leave or whatever, at any time, if he or she wishes. I think 5 years will be okay. But we'll talk about remuneration later. Please remind us to talk about it.
Can I get an indication from technical committee around the 3-5 years, whether there's a problem around 5 years? Sure. I just want to, before you reckon, I just want to warn members that we also don't expect council only to be able to do its work in year 3, because that in effect also what we're saying. We expect it to do their work from year 1. I hear the argument around the time that it takes you to get to know the environment, but I think we must be careful about that. So, Secretary, sorry, you were with
us. Thanks, Chair. I think that for us, that, 5 years may be a better option to take, because you have the same people being accountable for a longer period of time as well, so that needs to be taken into account. So, and just to clarify, it's only state people that don't get remunerated. If they're not state, they will get some remuneration for meetings, etc.
So can we then agree that we change 3 to 5?
Sorry, there is a sentence that they just add now, the Secretary Chaperon. She's just added a sentence which I requested you to talk about it later. She's just added it now. Can she just repeat the sentence so that I will hear, so that I won't take you back, okay?
Honourable Law, if I can ask you, it's coming on the next page. So let's leave it on the next page, but are we in agreement with the 5 years? Okay. Can you then change that to 5 years as well? I think also it is less onerous on the executive as well, for having to appoint every 3 years a new council and so on. Okay, let's go on to page 23.
Thank you, Chair. It is subsection 6. A councillor or a member of a committee appointed by the council referred to in section 30, who is not an employee of the authority or an officer or employee in the public service, may be paid from the funds of the authority such remuneration allowances as the minister may determine with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance.
Members, that was our own suggestion from the committee side, and I think we're comfortable with that one. Shouldn't be a problem. Is there anything, the remuneration, Honourable Ms. Law, of councillors is now, no, that's again. Yeah, it is. 6 and 7 speaks also to remuneration of councillors, 6 and 7. So can we have a look at that?
I think, Chairperson, they are differentiating from, if you go to 6, A, B, C, they are differentiating from the Chairperson and the Vice-Chairperson, as far as that 7 is concerned. I think it's referring to that, the Chairperson and the Deputy Chairperson. I think they are referring to that, indirectly.
Well, George and then Ms. Kulukamak.
My question, Madam Chair, is not to be discussed now, because when they come with this thing of the council and qualifications, probably this issue of remuneration again is going to affect. I'm assuming that you take a guy who's got a bull to be jurist, because you said law, he didn't even say whether he... And then a guy who's got a master, after LLP, then are you going to pay them the same amount? But not a matter for now, but once they qualify that, because also that's going to be affecting, because if you take a professor, surely you had paid a salary which you would. But I'm saying that this number 7 is also going to be affected when they finalize that issue of qualification for counsel.
Before I hand over to the technical team, I think 6 and 7 is still very confusing. And I think that's what we're hearing from members as well. I think what the one thing that we as members also need to understand is that councillors, whether you've got a master's degree or whether you've got no degree, if you're a councillor, except when you're the chairperson or the deputy chairperson, you are equal on the council. What this 7 is making provision for is if there's a committee established to do specific work and there's a councillor on that committee, that councillor can get extra remuneration, as I understand it here. Remuneration of allowance referred to in subsection 6, so go back to subsection 6, may differ according to different offices held by councillors or other persons or the different functions performed by them, by the issue.
Can I just clarify, if you look at the section where we have added in with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, there are scales set for public entities, and if you require the concurrence of the Minister, it would have to fall in the scales. Those scales will say a chairperson of an entity that falls within this category. If they are full-time, this is the amount they receive. If they are part-time, this is the hourly amount they receive. So we would be guided by those public entity scales now, because it has to go with, because one, there is a public entity, and two, because it has to occur with concurrence of the minister. Now that would, if you were to sit on a committee as councillor, obviously you would be paid according to the number of hours based on that public entity scale that you worked on that committee. So it wouldn't mean that you got an extra 5,000 rand a month. You'd have to say, I worked 10 hours on this and fill in a time log, and it would then be the hourly rate according to the public entity, because by adding in that with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance means we need to stick to those public entity scales, which we'd be happy to explain to you further if needed.
Yeah, I think the Secretary has just pretty much covered it. This must be already laid out in existing legislation. I don't think we're actually financially allowed to reinvent the wheel. The remuneration will no doubt relate exactly to those tenets of that law as it would for any other equality committee. So I think we're already covered. I don't think we can determine any of this. It's already covered in existing legislation.
Can I just ask the question, that would we still need 7 though? we don't need seven, and I think that's part of the confusing issue, is the fact that seven is there. So can we take out seven? Can the technical committee look at it, whether it's got any unforeseen consequences? Can we continue, please?
Thank you, Chair. On page 24, paragraph F, must establish and maintain liaison with the Civilian Secretariat for Police on policing and policy matters related to the private security industry. Chair, this has been reformulated after discussion of the committee.
Yeah, that's the partnership issues that's been reformulated as well. But can I ask you, General Jacobs, to take us through the functions of the Council so that we can see whether we are satisfied with what is in there as well, please?
Chair, I'll just go back to page 23 then. The functions of the Council and Chairperson. The Council must take steps to achieve the objects of the authority contemplated in Section 3 and to ensure performance of the duties of the authority. B, must oversee and exercise general control over the performance of the functions of the authority and of the activities of the persons appointed by it to perform the work of the authority. And C, may by notice in the Gazette make rules subject to the provisions of this Act and the Revis Act regarding 1, the good management of the affairs of the Council and the effective execution of its functions, and 2, any matter necessary or expedient for the proper performance of the functions of the authority. And 2, the Chairperson, they may, subject to ratification by the Council, exercise any power of the Council or fulfill any of its duties, must prepare the agenda of meetings of the Council, must sign the minutes of the meetings of the Council, must provide strategic direction to the Director and Council, may attend meetings of the senior management of the staff of the authority, and then lastly may establish and maintain liaison with the Civilian Secretariat for Police on policing and policy matters related to the private security.
Just the first thing, and the CPSMA must also come in. Under C, if we refer to finance now, we must refer to PFMA and the Levies Act, because the PFMA is also... Can I just ask, can we ask the technical committee to look, in terms of these functions, compare it with another council's functions? I'm a bit worried that we murk the waters somehow. That there are things that we expect the council to do that actually maybe the authority should be doing, and that we can just make, and I think it's part of the exercise that we've given the technical committee earlier where we said they must look at the roles and functions of CIROM, that we just make sure that there's no duplication, because you don't want that either, because then nobody takes responsibility in the end if something goes wrong. Members, anything that you want to add on this session? Okay, so they will come back to us on this. Honourable Ndlovu?
Chairperson, I'm not a good English speaker here. But if you say maternal liaison, what do you mean? Do you mean coordination or speaking together or meeting or what? What do you mean by that, maternal liaison? In brief, what do you mean by that? Because we're talking about human beings, we're not talking about these people. We're talking about people that will come after these people are here. What do you mean, maternal liaison?
Yeah, I think the Honourable Ndlovu is correct, it's not too woolly. Shouldn't it be now established and retain a relationship with Civilian Secretariat for Police on policing policy matters related to the private security? That we'd be more specific about it. So can you look at that, just maybe strengthening, maintain liaison? Accountability of Council.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want to mention firstly that we will come to the issue about accountability. In terms of the PFMA Act, the director of CIRA is the accountable person, and there's still reference in the Act to accountability. But I think in this sense of Section 10, it's dealing with the accountability of the Council towards the Minister. But I just want to flag it that we will come to the accountability of CIRA or the director in terms of the PFMA Act. Chair, then, in one, the Council is accountable to the Minister for the performance of its functions and must supply the Minister with such information and particulars as a minister may in writing require in connection with the functions of the authority or any other matter related to the authority. 2, the council must submit a report to the minister on any matter required by the minister under subsection 1 and on any matter which is necessary or expedient to bring to the attention of the minister, and be at least once a quarter in connection with the activities of the authority, including 1, the number of security service providers registered, sold, transferred, liquidated, suspended and dormant, the number of security officers registered, including category and functions, the details of training undertaken by registered security officers and training institutions, the number of firearms registered to, lost by, stolen or destroyed by security business. Chair, maybe I should just make an observation here. There was a long discussion about this specific course, and we did look at the firearms regulations. I think the committee will recall that when it comes to the regulation of firearms, that the committee indicated they don't want firearms regulations both under the CIRA Act and the Firearms Control Act. So the issue about regulation of firearms of the private security industry is regulated in terms of the Firearms Control Act. And in terms of those regulations, there are specific obligations in terms even of counselling when members of CIRA had been involved in a shooting incident. And in that specific one regulation, there is reference to this issue about a security officer in the performance of his or her duties causing death and injury. So we have put it up with the specific wording in the regulation. Then 6, the details of information of criminal investigations involving the private security industry. And 7, a monthly report in terms of the Public Finance Management Act to the minister.
Can I just say 3? If you look at 3, I think it's still not saying what we want. The details of training undertaken by registered security officers and training institutions. Not about the training institutions undertaking training. It is about the training institutions registered. That's what it's about. Because the way it's written here now, we're putting together the registered security officers training. It actually, the way it reads now, it reads that the training of training institutions. What we wanted is the same thing as you want with security service providers. This, in other words, training institutions, maybe you need another separate section. Training institutions registered, sold, transferred, liquidated, suspended, and dormant. That's basically what you want. Because one of CIRA's responsibilities is also the accreditation of the training institution. So if we can just separate the two issues there. Members, anything else there? Is this the things that we believe ministers should get reports on every quarter?
Chairperson, I'm getting confused now. Yesterday we didn't talk about anything about training. It seems as if yesterday's training, detail of training undertaken by registered security officers, we didn't say anything to it. But today, it's got a different tone altogether. Yesterday, Chairperson reads as follows. Detail of training undertaken by registered security officers, full stop. But here, the three that we are talking about now is expanded very big. A detail of training undertaken by registered security officers and training institutions.
That's exactly why I raised this point. I think it is I specifically asked yes, the training institutions be included, but not in the way that they've done it. It should be training institutions registered, sold, transferred, liquidated, suspended in government, same as the security service providers. That's what it should be. So they must split those two, Honourable McGlover, you're quite correct. 3 should just be up security officers, and then there should be a new number.
Even that, I think, might be a bit vague in relation to the details of training undertaken by registered security officers. Is it that you're asking, do they have the requisite qualification to be a security officer, or, you know, they might be trained to fly an airplane. It has nothing to do with his job at all. Are you also asking for that? So I think that has to be very specifically related to the qualifications they need to be registered as a security officer. Are they trained or not? If they are, they can have a license. If they're not trained, they can't. But it's too vague. It includes they might be qualified to be a doctor, any other training, to be any other thing, and then suddenly they've got these lists according to this legislation.
I think that can easily be addressed by saying detailed security training undertaken by registered security officers. And then, can I just say, two must now fall away. And I'm not talking about Roman two, I'm talking about two at bottom of the page. And it's dealt with now on 16A, and 16A needs to be moved here now. 16A deals with the annual report and the information that we require in the annual report. So 2 at the bottom of this page, 25, needs to be removed. 16A needs to be moved forward. 16A is that section that we dealt with, what we said, what information do we want in the annual report.
Okay, if I can just make an observation that maybe we need to revisit the wording of paragraph, Roman paragraph 6 as well. Because normally, if you have a police investigation that's ongoing, it's really just a matter for the police, and in terms of combating corruption and all those issues, it might be problematic to share that information while the investigation is ongoing.
I think we don't want to lose that point. I think we need to reword that point. The point might be the details of information of deregistration of private security officers as a result of criminal action. Maybe something like that. Because I understand what General Jacobs is saying. There's no way that they on every 3 months can give detail. So once the process is finalised, then the 3 monthly reports on deregistration because of criminal involvement. Honourable George?
That's the problem with the problem there is the way it is. I don't think it is wrong for them to give information of criminal investigation involving a private security industry. Probably the problem there is the way it is, because it is. Then it goes to what General Jacobs said, because it means now they must get into the nitty-gritties of the case. So I think let us take the word the details away and say information. Because they must give a report to the minister about private that is being investigated.
Mr. George, I agree with you. It might help, but I think it's not addressing the problem in its totality. Because the fact of the matter is, that CIRO won't even know in some instances that the police are busy investigating a security officer because of the crime that the security officer is involved in, because the security officer is not investigated as a security officer, he's investigated at Joe's Soap. They might only get to know about it at the point where they are told that this person now has got a criminal record and needs to be deregistered. So I think what they need to do is take in consideration what you say, so take in consideration what General Jacobs has raised, and just clean up 6 as well. 66.
Yes, Chair, because I think the other thing we need to also look at is how many criminal matters has CIRO brought to the police, because that's also something that you need. CIRO would pick up criminality. How many cases have they also referred to the police? We need to incorporate that into that process.
What we're basically saying is that the technical committee needs to apply its mind here. There are two separate things that we are talking about. The one is the details of security of criminal investigations brought to SAPS by CIRO. In other words, CIRO are saying to them, we have reason to believe, and they investigate. Secondly, they must also report on the number of security officers deregistered as a result of criminal investigations. So that was my point.
I thought 6 does not talk about security officer. It talks about private security industry. That's why I said there's no way Sirach must not give report, because surely if they an investigation in the private security industry, it means they should be knowing about that.
Honourable George is actually correct. Honourable George is correct about six, but it also now what he's unintentionally raised is the fact that we are missing the issue of security officers, and that needs to be looked at as well. You will look at 16 and moving it forward as well. And if we can continue, page 26.
Chair, section 11 dealing with the ministerial supervision of the authority, and the proposal is that paragraph D be inserted. In other words, that the minister responsible for taking such corrective measures as required by the circumstances in the period while there is no appointed council, and E, the interim appointment of a person or persons in accordance with section 6A to ensure the continuity of the affairs of the authority, provided that the interim appointment may not be exceed 90 days. So I think the issue was mentioned about limiting the period, and this was also
and it was just got to go and assist. So he's just leaving, just apologizing. You can continue.
Thank you, Chair. So there was a rewording of this to tighten it up and also to limit it to a period of 3 months in terms of interim. In other words, if you would sit with a situation where you don't have any council at all and the minister has to reappoint, and we think that 3 months should be a sufficient time in terms of the vetting and all the issues that must be considered, Chair.
I'm worried about the three months issue, because I vetting takes sometimes much longer than that. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have, but I am worried. And I just say 11, Act, all the Levies Act, and the PFMA. PFMA needs to be included there as well. Ms. Kulabona?
I think that actually that might cover it, because of course who determines if there is not a maintenance of an acceptable ban? It's got to be in relation to something. So perhaps the PMSA covers it. I don't think the Levies Act does sufficient. So maybe you could just look at how, in relation to what other acts we could perhaps insert there that would nail them if they were not doing their job. Because otherwise, who's going to determine they're not doing their job? I don't know where that lies. Certainly not the minister's not going to focus on what they do morning, noon, and night. So who's going to bring it to whom? Who's going to put in a complaint? I don't know.
Members, can I sketch a scenario for you? This committee has asked the Auditor General, and it's not even a scenario, it's a reality. This committee has asked the Auditor General for a performance audit on the building of Sira. The building, the painting of the building. Now, let's say there's something coming out of that speaks to this. It can also be this committee bringing certain things under the attention of the minister, or as a result of that, there would be issues that indicate that there's a problem. It can be through the Audit General's annual report, it can be. But I think what is important here is that we're giving direction to the minister in terms of this act, because this act describes the functions, the role, etc. So the minister, this act will guide the minister. The Levies Act will guide the minister, because the Levies Act places a certain responsibility on CIRAM. And then the PFMA. So I think that's the guidelines that we are looking at for the minister. But I'm still worried about the issue of 90 days. I'm really still worried about the issue of 90 days, especially with vetting. I'm a really vetted person.
Jay, maybe we can look at the period of 6 months, because you have something like an interim vetting or revisional vetting. I think 6 months should. I think once you go past 6 months, it also becomes problematic.
I think we're in agreement. We don't want it open ended. 6 months seems fine. Yeah. Now here's the issue of the meetings. Members, you wanted to talk about that. So can I ask General Jacobs, if you don't mind, just take us through page 27, even though there are no changes. No, the only changes on the next page. But if you don't mind taking us through 12, so that it puts in context.
Okay, Section 12, then the first meeting of the council must be held on such date and at such a time that and place as the minister may determine. All meetings of the council thereafter must be held on such dates and at such times and places as the chairperson may determine in consultation with the council. The chairperson may at any time convene a special meeting of the council and must also convene such a meeting at the written request of the minister. B. If at least three councillors request a special meeting in writing, the chairperson must convene such a meeting within 7 days after receiving the request. 3. The quorum for any meeting of the council is a simple majority of the councillors in office at the time. 4a. Subject to subsection 3, a decision of the council is taken by resolution, agreed to by the majority of councillors at any meeting of the council. B. In the event of an equality of votes regarding any matter, the chairperson has a casting vote in addition to his or her deliberative vote. 5. The procedure at a meeting of the council must be determined by the chairperson in consultation with council, and any decision in this regard must be taken after due consultation of transparency and fairness, provided that the law generally applicable to meeting procedures in South Africa must apply in the absence of a determination or agreement on the procedure to be followed. Then 6, the chairperson may, after consultation with the council, require the director or a deputy director contemplated in section 14.1 and allow any person to attend any meeting of the council on such conditions as the chairperson may determine. Then 7, a decision taken by the council or an act performed in terms of that decision is not invalid merely by reason of A. Any irregularity in the appointment of a councillor, B. A vacancy on the council, C. The fact that any person was not entitled to sit as councillor at the time the decision was taken, or D. The fact that the councillor is guilty of an act or omission justifying his or her removal from office. If such decision was taken by a majority of councillors present at the time and entitled to sit, and those councillors at the time constituted a quorum in terms of subsection 3. 8. A councillor may not attend, vote at, participate in, or influence any meeting or decision of the council if the councillor has a conflict of interest it may reasonably be seen to preclude the councillor from performing the relevant function in a fair, unbiased, and proper manner. 9. When the chairperson is absent or is unable to perform functions as chairperson, or whenever the office of the chairperson is vacant, the vice chairperson must act as chairperson during such absence or incapacity, or until a chairperson is appointed. 10a. If the chairperson and the vice chairperson are absent or unable to perform the functions of the chairperson, the council must appoint any other member to act as chairperson during such absence or incapacity. And then B, on page 29, if both the office of the chairperson and that of the vice chairperson are vacant, the minister must appoint any other person to act as chairperson until a chairperson or vice chairperson is appointed.
Members, there you have it. Questions on this? Ms. Kulabana?
Perhaps I've missed it, but what provision is there if the big person becomes no longer fit and proper? I mean, if they have a breakdown, if they are extremely ill, if they, whatever it is, is there some way to remove a person from this position, or any of the members from the position? If they rob a bank, if they do whatever it is, if they get a criminal record, or where is the provision that says we can get rid of them?
11.
Number 11.
In the 11, the previous one.
Chairperson.
What did you say about paragraph 6 yesterday? We said please. Didn't you say that?
No, I think it's correct the way it is. Now, we said that they wanted to have all a deputy director removed, and we said no, there's, you know, it's not needed. It's we had the discussion yesterday. And that any person to attend a meeting, prior in the Act we say, for instance, that they must be aligned with the Secretariat of Police. It might be necessary for them to attend a meeting of council to do them on something. And that's just making provision for them to be allowed in the meeting of the council. So I think the way it's reflected here is correct. I do, however, have a serious problem with 7. Look at 7. 7 is basically saying you can take any wrong decision at any point in time. And that decision stands. A decision taken by the council or an act performed in terms of that decision is not invalid merely by reason of any irregularity in the appointment of a councillor, a vacancy on council, the fact that any person was not entitled to sit as councillor at the time the decision was taken, or the fact that the council is guilty of an act or omission justifying his or removal from office if such decision was taken by the majority of the councillors, etc. I think I understand what they're trying to achieve is when there are vacancies and when there are people that are subsequent to those decisions being removed from the council, that that decision does not become invalid. But the way it's written here is extremely broad, and I think you have to have a look at that.
Can I just, you said to me that it's dealt with the removal of someone who is no longer suitable. You said it was dealt with under 11? Can you just tell me where? Is that the taking corrective measures? Or I wasn't sure what you had referred to.
I think I might have been, it refers to dissolving. I think you're more talking about the individual councillors. And I think it's maybe something that you need to look at. Is there provision for the minister to remove a councillor? Is there provision?
Section 8 there is that you know the disqualifications and what must be done after when there is a disqualification. It is addressed.
Can I suggest that we do the same as we've done with the objective of this Act? Because for me it's not only 7. If you look at 3, the quorum of any meeting of council is simple majority of councillors in office, which means that if you have 3 councillors in office, 2 people can eat and make a decision. So I think we need to look at other public entities and their rules, and because I also understand what's being done in 7, but I share the same concerns as the chairperson. So I'm asking if we could rework this section and come back to the committee with this section, because there are a couple of issues in this section that need to be addressed, and that we also then include the issue of the number of times that the council must meet.
I get a feeling from members, a suggestion in terms of there's no, at this stage, there's no provision for minimum number of times that the council must meet, and my feeling is if we ask for quarterly reports is that they should meet at least 4 times a year. Because surely the council wants to see the report before it goes to the minister.
It has with Jefferson.
We save at least 4 times a year, and then also, General Jacobs, the council must report on its meetings like all other public entities in the annual report of the authority. That there's provisions, if I remember correctly, on what those reports should include. It includes the people that were present, the people absent. I know even with on-school days, all those provisions. You can maybe just have a look at those provisions as well.
Can I raise an issue and just a concern? And I'll be covering that. If one look at a council, or writing legislation, I'm writing it for angels, personalities aside, and to depersonalise it myself as well. If there is an instance where a council member or council members suspect that there are governance issues or potential mismanagement or anything that might be in breach, there is no leverage or procedure for reporting to the minister as the person to whom the council accounts. And those are issues you often find if governance isn't very tight or if there are other problematic issues, and then there is a review and something is wrong, some of our council should have known or they should have acted upon that, and it becomes very difficult. Is there a possibility to maybe address that, because I'm raising it as a general concern and not specific to CEDA, but a safeguard for council members who would be appointed, but also the effective operation of the council as the oversight body and maintaining that level of integrity that is required, but also accessing that through a mechanism to a minister?
There can be no question about it. I think it must be dealt with in this section as well, and that's why we say go and look at other councils and what it says because there must be a mechanism to report. But I also think it's very important, and the council, as I understand this part of it as well, it's the council's responsibility to report to this committee as well. And that's why I'm talking about the report in the annual report that comes from CIRA on the activities of the council.
We could also, you see, the issue of one person who may become problematic, and I'm saying, okay, how do we remove them? But I think if we go a further step back, who do the other councillors, for example, report it to, saying this person is not arriving or arrived drunk or whatever the situation may be, who do you go to? I don't think that's dealt with. So I think you could, if you could also look at that, because you might find yourself between a rock and a hot place. You know you have a problem within the council, but unless it's legislated, who are you going to tell?
It's clear it's supposed to be the minister. We must just make it clear in the Act. So can we ask that you bring this in line with other legislation as well? Committee to assist the council. Can we continue there, please?
Thank you, Chair. The proposal is the amendment of Section 2, subsection to the council. Instead of may, to say must establish committees representing different sectors, disciplines or interests in the private security industry, to advise it regarding the regulation of the private security industry. And this is a new insertion, provided that no remuneration or allowances as contemplated in Section 8.6 may be paid to a member of a committee established in terms of this subsection. And the reason, Chair, is that this is really an attempt to get an reaction or the working relationship between the industry and CIRA. And it's more of a consultative forum than really working or tasking people to perform functions.
I think that's also a suggestion that came from the committee in any case, that this must be a must and that it also addressed the issue of that was right in the public submissions, that there is a breakdown between CIRA and the industry, and that we believe that that can be one of the ways to address it. Can I just ask that 31 be looked at as well? Not in terms of its content, but in terms of the way it's drafted. The council may appoint one or more committee consisting of one or more councillors, or even if you just put it underneath each other rather than in one sentence, or one or more councillors and one or more other persons, it just reads horribly. It absolutely reads horribly. So maybe you can have some things, or just layout might even already help. Can I just ask the other committees here and the other references, are there remuneration involved?
Yes, Chair, there may be remunerations involved. I think what we're trying to avoid is where it's an industry-specific committee that is dealing with the industry's interests, we shouldn't have to remunerate the industry for participating, but the other committees, it may be depending on the expertise that's left, there may be remuneration involved where you might want a particular person with an expertise to come in and assist the council as part of a committee.
Yeah, it's dealt with in 8.6, but for me it's very separated from each other, and that's why I'm asking that question. You know, it's almost like 8.6 should be reflected here, or referred to at least, referred to 8.6 in order to bring it together. We don't want arbitrary decisions on remuneration of such committees either. Staff of the authority.
Thank you, Chair. Here was just putting back the reference to the deputy directors that was removed, so in the final vote it won't be reflected, but just to show that those things back. Chair, was just a concern, if we look at on page 30 to subsection 3, we had a concern where we say that the director and the deputy directors might, in writing with the approval of the council, delegate any of their powers and assign any of their duties to a staff member. And the concern we have here is that whereas the director will be the accounting officer, that it's a strange obstruction then to say that powers can be delegated also by deputy directors.
So we would like to see, although elsewhere we have put back the deputy directors, but in this sense that we retain just the director in terms of making delegations.
I think that makes sense. Yeah, you see, this is a bit worrisome. You're missing very important issues that we've raised. We have made it quite clear in 14.1 that it must be done in consultation with the manager. The council must appoint a suitably qualified and experienced person as the director of the authority, as well as three directors on such conditions and terms as may be determined by the council in consultation with the minister. And that is for us a very important issue, because we, especially around the PFMA, it becomes a very important issue. Can I ask, I think if we relook the objectives and the functions of CIRA, if we relook the objectives and the functions of the council, obviously TUIS might be impacted on as well. So can you look at the, if after you've done the objectives and functions, just look at TUIS as well, whether you satisfied with it. For instance, 2C also needs to have PFMA added to it. And I'm not clear on 16A whether we are saying who's responsible for the annual report either. I mean, that's what I'm saying. We need to look at this thing in totality, please. Page 30, 2C, ensure that the functions of the authority are performed in terms of this Act, the Levies Act and the PFMA.
Chair, and maybe we will also reconsider the issue of in sub 2, the reference to deputy directors as well, because the functions are actually laid down, and in terms of the accountability, I think the main responsibility remains with the director.
Can you just, have you done the whole thing now?
Yes, just on page 31, we have inserted the Public Finance Management Act in subsection 4A, and then in subsection 7 that was inserted, the fixed establishment, the number and grading of posts of the authority must be determined by the council with the approval of the minister.
Yeah, you've got to relook this whole section. Because 6 is also problematic. 6 is saying that the council from time to time, now time to time can be every 4 months, must relook the allowances, subsidies and conditions of service remuneration of the authority. And again, it's not linked to the minister. And I really, you know, I think this whole section needs to be re-looked at. And then we still need staff appointed in terms of the succession, may either be appointed as employees or in terms of a contract for a fixed period. Why do we have the Honourable Mulabati?
Chairperson.
Honourable Mulabati.
In paragraph 6, Chairperson, you just remove from time to time and put in consultation with the minister and remove from time to time. If you read that sentence, associated and other services benefited by the council from, and then you remove from time to time in consultation with minister.
Well, Glover, I think to some extent this issue is problematic because of funding model as well. And that's why I say then as a look at, you're right, that will address the problem at the moment. But the funding model will also play a role. Because if Treasury in the end decides to fund, it will be according to public service agreements. If Treasury does not agree, then we are looking at a different way of determining it. You're right by addressing that, saying remove time to time and add in consultation with the minister. But I think we need to have a relook at this whole section in order that we don't piecemeal try and cover some issues. Because I want to stop the meeting here for today. On Tuesday, we are going to start at 9:30 with the committee only and the researchers. 9:30, committee only and the researchers. 11:00, Sira can join us for the annual report presentation. We will then not require the technical committee for Tuesday. Wednesday we will ask the technical committee and we will expect copies on time, because you've now got enough time to do so. A clean-up version of what we have, also these references to the FMI where they need to come in, done already, so that we don't pick them up. Re-look up to page 31, the things that we've said and the things that we've discussed earlier today from 66 onwards as well. We're not requesting that you have ready on Wednesday already the memorandum, neither the long title. But those other issues need to be cleaned up so that on Wednesday we can then continue with it. Tuesday, 11:00, CIRA, the council annual report. 9:30, members and the researchers for briefing beforehand. Thank you very much. So tomorrow there is no obligations. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.